Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. Republican-led U.S. Congress began its 115th session Tuesday with a swearing-in of members and the re-election of Paul Ryan as Speaker.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. This is the kind of thing that most of us only dreamed about. I know because I used to dream about this a lot. The people have given us unified government. And it wasn't because they were feeling generous. It was because they want results.
House Republican lawmakers dropped plans to take control of the Independent Office of Congressional Ethics, a move that could have limited the group's ability to investigate wayward lawmakers. Syrian government forces have escalated their attacks near the capital, Damascus. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the army is trying to capture the water-rich areas around the village of Wadi Barada and Barada Valley. The government says rebels have damaged key water infrastructure, causing water supplies to be cut. Meanwhile, a coalition of rebel groups say they will suspend their participation in preliminary peace talks set for later this month in Kazakhstan. The rebels say they are withdrawing because they say the government is violating the current ceasefire. Suspected Muslim rebels attacked a jail in the southern Philippines Wednesday, releasing more than 130 inmates. A jail official says one guard was killed in the incident at North Cotabato District Jail in Kitapawan. Turkish media have broadcast a video of a man they say is the suspected gunman who killed 39 people during a New Year's attack on an Istanbul nightclub. The video appears to be from a cell phone. The man does not speak in it. This is VOA News. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump Tuesday criticized General Motors, the country's biggest automaker, for sending its Mexican-made Chevrolet Cruze models for sale in the U.S. tax-free. Trump threatened to impose a hefty tariff on the company. GM says it already makes most of its Cruze cars in the U.S. Meanwhile, the Ford Motor Company Tuesday scrapped plans to build a new factory in Mexico. The company says it will instead expand a plant in Michigan to build electric and self-driving cars.
A $700 million investment and 700 new U.S. jobs, resulting in the transformation of this plant into one of the world's most flexible and high-tech manufacturing centers.
Ford Chief Executive Mark Fields, he called it a vote of confidence in Trump's pro-growth policies. Meanwhile, Trump tapped Robert Leitziger as the U.S. trade representative. A free trade skeptic, Leitziger is expected to take a hard line against China. An Indian minister has received widespread criticism for suggesting that Western clothes were responsible for a series of sexual assaults in the city of Bangalore on New Year's Eve. Karnataka Home Minister G. Parameshwara made the remark to the Times Now television network. And Abu Amzi, leader of the Indian regional Samajwadi Party, echoed those comments, blaming women's short dresses for the incidents and calling Western influence a blot on the Indian culture. Lathika Kumaramangalam of the Indian National Commission for Women called on Parameshwara to resign over the comments.
Man at that level of society, or, you know, who's obviously an important part of what sort of decisions take place in this country, talks like that. Where is this country heading?
Local media say hundreds of women fled the streets and hid behind police as a mob descended on them on New Year's Eve.
Vidat Paris, Vidat Sark.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Tuesday a planned Middle East peace conference in Paris is futile. 70 countries are expected to participate in the January 15th event, but Israel will not. Mr. Netanyahu worries that the meeting will result in new United Nations resolutions against Israel. The meeting is expected to reiterate international support for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There are reports Tuesday that notorious serial murderer Charles Manson has been taken from a California prison to a local hospital in Bakersfield, California. Prison officials have not yet confirmed the reports. The 82-year-old Manson has been in prison since 1971, serving 9 life sentences for a series of 7 murders. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today's Wednesday, January 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. There's confirmation Gambia's Elections Commission chairman, who reportedly fled the country, is in neighboring Senegal.
I can confirm that the chairman of the Independent Electoral Commission of the Gambia, Alhaji Momorou Ndiaye, left Banjul on Sunday and arrived in Dakar on Monday morning. I spoke with him briefly, and then he confirmed that he is currently in Dakar, Senegal.
That's VOA stringer Seni Marina in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. South Sudanese refugees learn new cultures in Uganda. Lay health workers in Zimbabwe offer basic therapy in treating mental health. And DRC's ruling coalition says President Kabila should have the privilege to renew or end the Catholic bishop's mediation mandate.
President Kabila gave a mandate to Catholic bishops to rule mediation. Now, we reach an accord. The bishops have to present their reports to President Kabila. So the president has now to appreciate.
Andre Alain Atundi is the spokesman for President Joseph Kabila's ruling coalition. Lawyers for Equatorial Guinea's vice president have asked French courts to delay his corruption trial. And a group of Muslim and Christian hip-hop artists are rapping for reconciliation in the Central African Republic. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. It has been confirmed that Gambia's Electoral Commission chairman, Aliou Mama Ndiaye, who reportedly fled the country due to alleged threats against his life, is in neighboring Senegal. VOA stringer Sidney Marina, who is in the Senegalese capital, says he spoke by phone with Mr. Ndiaye. He joins us now by phone from Dakar. Good morning to you, Marina.
Good morning from Dakar, Senegal.
The story is that the chairman of the Gambian Election Commission, Mr. Aliou Ndiaye, has fled the country. Can you confirm that?
I can confirm that the chairman of the Independent Electoral Commission of the Gambia, Alhaji Momorou Ndiaye, left Banjul on Sunday and arrived in Dakar on Monday morning. I spoke with him briefly, and then he confirmed that he is currently in Dakar, Senegal.
Did he tell you why he left the country?
He did not tell me actually why he left the Gambia, but media reports indicated that he left the Gambia because of imminent threat to his life after declaring Adama Barrow as the winner of the December presidential election, in which incumbent President Yahya Jammeh is disputing at the moment and then at the Supreme Court of the Gambia.
We understand that you also are planning to speak with him officially.
Yes, I spoke with him and I told him we wanted to have an interview with him. And he said he will grant me an interview probably today, Wednesday. He will speak to me probably. He told me that I should give him some time to relax because he just arrived and then he will grant us an interview.
It would be interesting to ask him whether he did tell President Jammeh that his commission found some irregularities in the results of the election. Because according to President Jammeh, the commission said it found some irregularities for which he, Jammeh, has gone to court.
Yeah, already he granted interview to a local press and made it clear that there was no irregularities as claimed by President Jammeh. The defeat was shocking to Jammeh that he could not believe that he lost this election. So the IEC chairman, Ndiaye, made it categorically clear that there was no irregularities in the polls. And then Adama is still the president-elect. So that is something that I will also further put to him to hear from him about the entire situation.
You know that President Yahya Jammeh has sued the Elections Commission. What effect, if any, do you think his flight out of the country, do you think that might have any impact on the lawsuit filed by President Jammeh that is in the Supreme Court?
Yes, what happened was that when Mr. Ndiaye declared Adama Barrow winner of the presidential election, the Independent Electoral Commission headquarters were seized by armed men for 2 weeks. Later, the armed men left the office and gave excuse that the office was under imminent threat. But that was just an excuse. We realized that, you know, the armed men seized this office and they have already tampered with some of the documents of the Independent Electoral Commission. So they were not at work immediately 1 week after the presidential election was held. So Ndiaye himself complained to visiting ECOWAS leaders when he visited Jammeh in Banjul some couple of weeks ago that his security was at stake because the state is not providing him security as it's supposed to be.
When is this Supreme Court hearing expected?
The Supreme Court hearing is expected early next week, 10 January. Already the Supreme Court Chief Justice, which is a Nigerian, said at least 7 judges should be able to sit at the Supreme Court. And all these 7 judges, none of them are Gambians. This has also raised fears among, you know, the coalition and among ordinary Gambians why the composition is purely foreigners, including Nigerians and Sierra Leonean judges who have been used by Jammeh in the past to try political motivated cases in his favor. So the Supreme Court will reconvene on the 10th January to look at this petition. And Jammeh has vowed that he is not going to hand over power unless the Supreme Court decide on this matter. And the coalition today held a press conference again, and they said President-elect Adama Barrow will be sworn in on the 19th. This is the statement made by ECOWAS also that come 19 January, Adama Barrow will be sworn in as the president despite this Supreme Court challenge.
All right, Sini, thank you very much again for joining us. And we look forward to your interview, possibly, with the Elections Commission chair.
Thank you. My pleasure speaking to you, James.
That's VOA Stranger Sini Marina speaking with us from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. A spokesman for President Joseph Kabila's ruling coalition says it is only logical for the president to renew or end the mandate of the Catholic Bishops' Conference, which brokered the New Year's Eve agreement. The bishops are expected to present their report to Mr. Kabila sometime this week. But one opposition leader, Moise Katumbi, has been quoted as saying any attempt by Mr. Kabila to delay the process would not be accepted. The agreement calls for President Kabila to remain in power until elections are held at the end of this year. André Alain Atunde, spokesman for President Kabila's ruling coalition, says it would be in the interest of the country for the bishops to continue their mediation effort, but he said it would depend on what President Kabila decides.
You know, the President Kabila gave a mandate to Catholic bishops to rule mediation. Now, we reach an accord the last day of the year. To go further, the bishops have to present their reports to President Kabila. So, the president has now to appreciate if it is necessary to give them the same mandate to achieve an inclusive accord. This is what is logical, I think, normal for their mandate. President Kabila give mandates, they give reports, and President Kabila has to appreciate if stop their mandate or they continue. But I think it should be maybe better for coalition with majority and Chamberma and voters to give the bishops the opportunity to continue until everyone can sign this accord. But it depends on what is the appreciation of President Kabila.
But some people say that by trying to get President Kabila involved, this is an attempt to delay the process.
No. You know, political process is a very difficult and complex. You can remember about the negotiation between America and Vietnam and so on. So this is, first of all, you must to notice that negotiations are continuing in order to have a particular arrangement. It means how to accomplish all the articles of the accord. So this is a very, very complex problem. We cannot say it will be resolved in 1 day or 2 days. It depends on the goodwill of everyone and on the complexity of the situation.
If I hear you correctly, it seems to me your coalition is saying that the office of the president should still be respected. That's why your coalition is urging that President Kabila should have a role in approving the mediation.
No, it's illogical. He gave mandate, and the people to whom he gave mandate, to give him reports. and he has to decide we continue or not, or what direction we have to take. There's no particular problem about this.
Mr. Atundi, do you think your country is on the road to stabilization, to save for peace with this agreement?
Definitely, I think so. Because, first of all, we can see that the tension, the social tension, decrease. And the politicians are now, I can say, they show a good will to reach this consensus. And I think this is the right way to go to election, good election, peaceful election, and non-violent post-election situation. So this accord raises a big hope to Congolese people, of course, I think, international communities also.
André Alain Atunde is the spokesman for President Joseph Kabila's ruling coalition. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Today is Wednesday, January 4th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Lawyers for Equatorial Guinea Vice President Teodori Obiang have asked a French court to delay the politician's trial in Paris, where he is currently accused of corruption and money laundering. Watchdog groups say Obiang, son of Equatorial Guinea's president, is guilty of siphoning more than $225 million of public funds for his personal use. The leader, who was appointed to his vice president role by his father just last year, is being tried in absentia. Tutu Alakante is executive director of the U.S.-based Ek Justice. He tells Ricky Schreier he and other activists are concerned the president will eventually appoint his son as the new president so that he can evade charges if found guilty.
Well, we know that since he was in his early 20s, his father had put most of the arable land in Equatorial Guinea in his hands, at which point he was also Minister of Agriculture. And that is when he started extorting money, embezzling money, and wiring most of that money to places like France and the United States to purchase assets. Some of the assets, they have now become part of a settlement in the U.S. and now the case in Paris and investigations also in places like Switzerland and other places.
What about to those who would say that Obiang works in the government? Yes, he's taken advantage of his father's connections, but he's made this money honestly. What about that argument?
Well, I would like those people to tell me how someone on their $5,000 a month salary acquires over $100 million mansion in Paris, $30 million mansion in Malibu, millions of dollars in luxury cars in the United States, in Switzerland, in Paris, two multi-million dollar yachts in Switzerland, etc., right? So the amount of money that we're talking about here, you know, is not pittance.
Does the younger Obiang, does he play a role in any of the oil companies? Does he have any jobs outside of the government job?
One of the things that we know that he's also in charge of arm trade, right? So basically any arms that come into Equatorial Guinea is deals that Teodorini is signing. There again is an avenue for corruption.
France is a former colonial power in Africa. It looks a little bit like, you know, the colonial power coming in and playing a parental, quote, role. Why does France have a right to, do you think, put on trial Obiang?
I think citizens of Equatorial Guinea have a right to the truth. They have a right to benefit from the assets generated in that country, from the revenues generated in that country. Unfortunately, we're talking about a country where there is no rule of law, where Teodorin and his father, who have embezzled, most of whom have embezzled billions in Equatorial Guinea, cannot be put on trial in Equatorial Guinea. I think those that, you know, are thinking of paternalistic or neocolonial argument, you know, should look at the injustices being committed by African leaders today, right? And again, that's not just Equatorial Guinea. You go to Angola, which is another oil-producing nation, and it's the same situation, right? I mean, I think we need to be looking at, do we have the mechanisms in our country to hold our own African leaders accountable for squandering millions and millions of dollars when children are dying in hospitals, when people do not have running water, when people do not have education, right? Rather than looking at whether France or the U.S. or anyone else is holding these people to account. Because the truth of the matter, we cannot have a situation where our own leaders are allowed to stash monies away in Switzerland, in France, in other places, while people are dying of poverty in our countries.
Host Tutu Ali Kant, Executive Director of Egg Justice. You are speaking to Ricky Stryak from North Carolina, USA. South Sudanese and Sudanese refugees in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, say they are learning new cultures. They say despite the enormous challenges they face, learning to live with people of different cultures helps them adapt to the new environment. Mugumi Davis Rakarinja has the story from Kigali, Rwanda.
Sadiq Umarizba, called Juba City in the Arua Park section of downtown Kampala, usually filled capacity with people from all over East Africa, including Sudanese, South Sudanese, Ugandans and Congolese. Umar, a Sudanese from Darfur region, did business in South Sudan up until violence broke out in late 2013, which led more than a million people fleeing their homes during the three-year-long conflict. Speaking in Arabic, 32-year-old businessman says adapting South Sudan culture was never a problem. He says living in South Sudan did not give him any difficulties. Umar says they have a common culture and speak the same language. So living in South Sudan was not challenging because they were the same people before separation, including the food they ate. But when violence broke out in Juba in December 2013, Umar says people looted his grocery shop in Juba's Konyokonyo market, forcing him to flee to Kampala. With the help of a Ugandan friend, Umar spent time trying to figure out which kind of business he could run in Kampala. Using most of his savings, Umar opened the Juba City Bar in March 2014. Like other Sudanese and South Sudanese living in the Ugandan capital, Umar says it was a bit challenging adapting a new culture and learning a new language. More than 2 years after he set up his bar and restaurant, Umar says he still uses sign language or speaks through a translator when addressing Ugandans or people from other countries. But overall, he says life in Uganda is good. Gabriel Kir, who is studying for a master's degree at Uganda's Makerere University, says he too finds it easy to live in Uganda. Kerr says Ugandans are very sociable and accommodating.
Emerging from conflict in South Sudan decades back, they realized that what they need most is harmonious coexistence. Because if you live in harmony, your business thrives and you get to get along with the people, because the same people you are staying with could be your customers, they could be your neighbors, they could help assist you in one way or the other. Probably they value that.
Peter Gatruak, an urban refugee living in Kampala's Kansanga suburb, says he enjoys Ugandan culture, but he complains that despite the hospitable nature of Ugandans, he's sometimes harassed by police officers who arrest him and demand bribes.
I've been arrested by police without reason, and when they arrest me, they ask me, man, you support your dogman. I tell, how can I support the government? I didn't do anything. But I just moving around, I'm going to home. They catch me. Come on here, Sudanese. By the way, they are disturbed. They mean they want money, by the way. And I don't have money.
Gatruak says he was eventually released without charges last November. Hundreds of South Sudanese live peacefully in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, as students, refugees, and businessmen and women. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Kigali, Rwanda.
Doctors say mental health trouble is a hidden crisis in much of Africa, but lay health workers in Zimbabwe have been offering private therapy sessions on the grounds of clinics in Harare. A trial conducted by the University of Zimbabwe, along with the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine at King's College London, shows the therapy has led to big improvements in mental health. As Henry Richwell reports, the treatment could serve as a blueprint for tackling mental health problems in Africa.
Doctors estimate one in four Zimbabweans suffers depression or anxiety, but there are just 12 psychiatrists treating the entire population of 14 million, says Dr. Victoria Sims of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
We can't possibly go the route of training psychiatrists and psychologists because it would take 15 years. How are we going to provide treatment?
Local doctors have come up with a simple but seemingly highly effective answer. Wooden seats, so-called friendship benches, were installed on the grounds of several Harare health clinics. Visitors were offered 6 one-on-one counselling sessions with lay health workers, known as grandmother health providers. Again, Dr. Victoria Sims.
The very lowest cadre of the health system, to train those women to offer problem-solving therapy. And so the patient explains what all their problems are, and it's opening up the mind in the sense of allowing the patient to see that they can do something about their problems.
The study involved more than 550 patients. After 6 months, only 14% of the patients in the friendship bench group reported symptoms of depression, compared to 50% in a control group. They were also 5 times less likely to have suicidal thoughts. The co-founder of the Friendship Bench program, Dr. Dixon Chibanda of the University of Zimbabwe, told VOA via Skype the intervention had a wide range of benefits.
Not only a mental health sort of package, but a package that actually improved outcomes of things like hypertension, diabetes, and adherence to medication for people living with HIV.
That success has led to friendship benches being rolled out to 60 clinics in Harare and 2 other cities. The Canadian government is helping to fund the expansion through its Grand Challenges Canada aid program, making it one of the biggest programs in sub-Saharan Africa. Researchers say it could be a blueprint for mental health in low-income regions and could even offer lessons for treatment in richer countries. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In the Central African Republic, a group of hip-hop artists came together to ring in the new year with calls for peace and reconciliation. Zach Bardov has the story from Bangui.
Meet One Force, a hip-hop collective made up of both Christians and Muslims.
One Force est une arme pour combattre la violence.
One Force is a weapon to fight violence. If we want to rescue the Central African Republic for tomorrow, we have to change ourselves.
A student in Bangui, Leono Foto, founded One Force. The chorus of one of their songs is simply, "We want peace." The CAR hasn't been the same since the Seleka rebel coup in 2013. Militia rose up against the mostly Muslim rebels, and the country exploded into communal violence.
I watched it in front of me, a massacre of little children. I saw anti-Balaka and Seleka massacre young people. But this violence must stop, because we want peace.
Reconciliation won't be easy, but Foto says he brought these rappers together last year to serve as an example that it is possible. They take every opportunity to send that message, including in their choice of venue for the New Year's Eve concert. This mostly Muslim neighborhood, known as PK5, was a flashpoint during the crisis. It saw a lot of violence, and most of the people who lived here had to flee. It remains tense even now.
People are a bit scared to come in this part of the city, and also scared to organize events or concerts in this part of the city.
Hip-hop artist Mohamed Saleh says it's time to put an end to the mistrust.
That's reporter Zach Bardov in Bangui, Central African Republic. And that is it for this Wednesday, January 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington saying have a nice day, Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day. Some things change, some remain the same. From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC GMT right here on VOA Africa.